We are at up to the last part of Perek Yud, chapter 10, the chapter which wouldn't die. It just keeps right on going. Yeah. Well, we've been through the war on behalf of Givon. We've been through the sun, the moon, the miracles, and now we get to the rest of the war. We saw last week, Pesukim Tedvav to Chavala 15 to 21, we're finishing up the war. Did they go back to Gilgal? Did they not go back to Gilgal? And disposing of the five kings who were in the cave. General rule, don't hide in the cave. There's no other way out. This is what I sent out this week.
Yeah.
Okay. You haven't. So, great. So, what we have now in Pasuk Chachet, sentence 28, is the remainder of the wars to the south. This is now the five kings that began this are defeated, so there's no concern about them coming back to attack the Jews from behind as they go on their way, and so the Jews begin their offensive with Makeda, which we had mentioned already briefly last time. If you take a look at Pasuk Chachet, sentence 28. V'ez Makeda l'achad Yoshua b'yomahu. Yoshua conquered Makeda that day, v'yakeh l'fi cherev v'ez malkah. He strikes Makeda by the sword, he kills the king as well, hechrim osam. He destroyed them, v'ez kol hanefesh asher ba. And all of the lives there, lo ishir sarid, he leaves nothing. Vayas the Melech Makeda, Kasher Asal the Melech Yericho. He did to the king as he had done to the king of Yericho, which Radak explains means that he kills him and leaves the body out for the day. Now the truth is, we never knew that he did that to the king of Yericho. We saw him do it to the king of Ai. We saw him do it to the five kings that were in the cave. We didn't know he had done this to the king of Yericho, but that is understood to be what he did here. So he defeats Makeda, and then Vayavor Yehoshua, this is just straight read here. Vayavor Yehoshua v'chol Yisraeli momi Makeda Livna. They went from Makeda, they went Livna. Presumably that means to the place called Livna. Vayitein Hashem Osa Gam Osa Biyad Yisrael. I'm sorry, Vayilachim Lim Livna. He fought Livna. Vayitein Hashem Gam Osa Biyad Yisrael. V'yes Malka. God gave Livna and its king in the hands of Israel. Vayakeha lefi cherev, he struck them by the sword. Veskol hanefesh asher ba, and all those who lived there. Lo ishir ba sarid, he left nothing. Vayaz lemalka kasher asal lemelech Yericho, and he did to their king as he had done once again to the king of Yericho. But he's not done. Vayavor Yehoshua v'chol Yisrael imo mi Livna Lachisha. They then went from Livna to Lachish. Vayichan aleha. He camped there, Vayilachem ba, and he fought with Lachish. Vayitein Hashem es Lachish v'yad Yisrael. God gave Lachish in the hands of Israel. Vayokida bayom hasheni. There it took 2 days for this battle. He conquered them on the second day of the battle. As he had done to Livna, he strikes all the residents, so too, that's what he does to Lachish. Pasuk Lamed Gimel, sentence 33. Az Allah Horam Melech Gezer Lazores Lachish. Then Horam, king of Gezer, arose to help Lachish. And here the wording is different. We're not phrasing it as Yeshua went from X to Y, and he fought them, and he did this to them. But we mention Horam, king of Gezer, in Pasuk Lamed Gimel. We mention Horam, king of Gezer, as an actor here, rising to help Lachish. And according to the Dat Mikra, Gezer is one of the best known of these early cities of Canaan. And it was, I'm just looking to see if he mentions anything in particular that we want to mention. No. But in general, Gezer was a great city. It was a city that, it's actually a lot of it has been dug up. There's a lot of archaeological work done on Gezer. Shlomo builds it up and fortifies the city in Malachim Aleph. So the city in general is going to play a greater role.
Where does it exist today?
So, today it's a ruin. You know, it's a place you can visit and find the ruin. But yeah, they know where it was.
Where is it?
So what he says here, what that mikra offers, is that it's Bitzfon Hashfela, the northern area of the lowlands. I had that map that I showed last week, in which Gezer is placed. Do they actually mark Gezer on the map?
Together.
Yeah, they don't. Oh, they do. They suggest that Gezer is actually up north on the same level as Givon and Ayalon, but west of them. So it's northwest of Yerushalayim.
That's the best that takes L.
Right, so how, okay, so you how come?
I'm not sure what course this, but I see Nestor Fate L right on the Mediterranean.
In the art school one. That's interesting.
You see Nestor the Mediterranean here?
Well, no, Mediterranean's not in my picture.
I see Gezer there.
Gezer's, but yeah.
Interesting. Well, it fits in terms of being northwest of Yerushalayim. It could be that the shore is just that close. Yeah, that would fit.
Isn't Lachish much further south?
Yes. So according to this, they actually take a... Well, you'll see why. Because, as we're going to see here, Gezer intervenes. It wasn't the next logical place to go. It was Gezer that got involved.
What were they aiming for?
So what, right, so what...
They killed all the people.
Right, so what we noted... Yeah, what we noted last week is that what he's trying to do is conquer this sort of central region, central to southern region, Yerushalayim down southward towards Hebron, that area. These are the people who had fought against him. These are the people who had rallied their forces against him, and he is now sweeping the area. Gezer doesn't fit because Gezer chose to attack. The other ones were in this region. They're the Canaanim who he's going after.
All the inhabitants?
He is wiping out the inhabitants. Remember the rule that they're told. They're told, make peace if you can. But if they don't want to make peace, then you have to fight against them. I'm sending you there because I am fed up with Canaan. You are entering this land for that reason.
It would have been okay if they just made peace with, let's say, everyone decided to make peace. They were supposed to be going in and taking
off
the
land. If they had said, we're going to keep the Noahide laws, we're going to pay you tribute, okay. Mm-hmm. We're going to see that explicitly in
the land of the Jews?
Yeah. But the land of the Jews
doesn't make peace.
It's not so much land of the Jews as it is land of God. And if non-Jews are going to keep their mitzvot, so they can live in the land of God. That's, you know, Ger Tosha.
With all these good people.
That's a problem. But take a look. Gezer isn't supposed to be involved yet. Azalah Horam Melach Gezer. Then Horam, king of Gezer, chose to get involved. Lazorus Lachish, in order to help Lachish. Vayakeh Yoshua ve'esamo ad bilti yishir lo sarid. So Yoshua says, okay, them too. They then go from Lachish to Eglon. They camp by Eglon to fight them. They fought there. They conquered Eglon that day. Same thing. He attacks them, he conquers them, he wipes them out, and the emphasis of Bayom Hahu, that day, he doesn't even need the two-day battle that he needed in the battle for Lachish. Vayal Yoshua b'chol Yisrael imo me'eglona Chavrona. Then they go up to Chavron. They've been going in this sort of circle, right? Now they went west, they went south, and now they're going back east. So they're going to Hebron. I don't know what that looked like on the camera. I hope it made sense. Vayilachamu aleha. It made even less sense on the audio. Vayilachamu aleha. And they fought against Hebron, right? Vayokidua, they conquered her. Vayakua lefichereb, by the sword. Vesmalka, veskolareha, the king, her cities. And what we mean by her cities is generally understood to mean the suburbs, the areas around it. Veskala Nevesh Asher Ba, all those who were in it, Loishir Sarid, he left nobody. Kahala Sharasala Eglon, Bachre Mosa, Veskala Nevesh Asher Ba, he destroyed it and everything in it. Now, worth noting here, the conquest of Hebron poses a particular problem. Because when you go back earlier to the five kings who were in that cave, right, go back to Pasuk Chaf Yemo, please. Sentence 23. And who do we see is in your five?
Melech
Hebron.
And Melech Lachish.
Right. And Melech Eglon.
No, I know.
Right. So the other ones aren't a problem. Because the other ones didn't say anything about the king here. It said they conquered Lachish. It didn't say anything about their king. But here we're saying that he conquered Hebron and the king.
Maybe the new king who took over.
So that's one answer. One answer is there had been a king. The king was gone, and now there is time. I mean, you're fighting all these other wars in between. So that's one possibility. Take a look on your sheet at source number two. Actually, did I? Source number one was just a link to some material on the archaeology done in Gezer. I'm not ready for number two yet. I made a mistake with that one. But Radak's answer was it was a replacement king for the one they had killed earlier. Malvim says there were two kings. Keep in mind, we use the word king in a way that's different from the way they used the word king. King meant the head of the area where the clan lived. But we've already seen that there were multiple cities associated with particular Kanani tribes. And each city could theoretically have its own king. Bless you. So you could have this group that's in Hebron, and there's this group that's in Hebron, and each one is going to have its own leader, its own melech. So Malbim offers that as a solution. But there's a bigger problem with Hebron. If you flip ahead for a second to Perek Yudalit, chapter 14. I don't know. That was before I came in. I didn't see anyone there.
Oh, okay. So it's not here.
I don't know, somebody, when I was driving up, I don't know, she sat like over there last time. I just
Shirley?
Shirley?
Shirley is here. Is there a name in this
house? And they said that you had to go to drive your daughter somewhere.
Kat, Sima.
Oh, Sima.
No, I wasn't here. I literally walked in one there. Just when she came here, you came here?
No.
I was in the washer. You were in the washer? She's not there.
Okay. She must have left.
Leaving all her stuff.
Leaving her coffee behind.
I don't know. Do you want to text her?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So she was here.
I don't know. When I came in, no one was here. Okay.
Sorry, Hillary.
Okay. So looking at Perek Yudalit. And what you want is the end of the Perek. Chapter 14. And specifically, what we're looking at is Kalev ben Yefuneh speaking to Yahushua, and then after the speech, which we'll get to when we get to Perek Yudalit, if you look at Pasuk Yud Gimel, right? There we are told, basically what we're told in this Perek is that Kalev conquers Hebron. That's really the point. But if Kalev is the one who conquers Hebron in Perek Yudalit, then who conquered it in Perek Yud?
Or did they get it back?
Did they get it back? Did they lose it in between? Like, what happened? So if you take a look at source number two, Malbim offers a couple of solutions. He says, Hineh lekaman mavor shekalev lachadis Hebron b'chamishit. Further along, it's going to be explained that Kalev conquers Hebron in the fifth, which means the fifth year, as I added in brackets there. L'chnisasam la'aretz, the fifth year after they enter the land. V'chei mashakasav achar kach sheYoshua lachad es Devira. Further, it's going to say that Yoshua conquered the city of Devir. So ser mashakasav she'Asniel ben Kenaz l'chada. That's going to contradict what it says in Shoftim, that Asniel conquered Devir. So, how do I understand this? Betzorach lomar she Yehoshua lachad es ir Hebron. The Kalev chavash migrishei ha'ir v'chatzei re'ah. His first answer is that there is the city, and then there are the outlying areas. The areas outside of it, you have the farms, you have maybe mini communities that are called satellites of the main community. Kimavur sham sharaks dei ha'ir v'chatzei re'ah nasnu l'Kalev. Because what's clear there in Perek Yudalit is that they give Kalev specifically the fields outside the city, the outskirts of the city. The Hebron atzma, ha'isayir ha'levim, but Hebron itself is a city of the Levim. It doesn't go to Kalev. Kalev is from Yehuda. Kimavur lekaman, as we'll see in Perek Chafalev. In fact, Hebron is one of the Ari Miklat. It's very crowded now. So you've got Yehuda, Levim, and the Ari Miklat, the cities of refuge, generally were Levite cities. Right, that's true. But now you're bringing in Yehuda as well. So he says the answer is that Kalev captured the outskirts of the city, and that's what was given to him. Yahushua got the city itself. And we'll apply that to Devir too. That's his first answer. His second answer, which Abarbanel takes as well, is V'gami Yishlomar Shasi portion Iskar Lekaman Simen Yudalit Mekomo Kan. What you're going to see in chapter 14 actually belongs here. In other words, what we're describing in these prakim is not a description that should be read linearly, like, okay, here are all these conquests, and then the events of Perek Yud happen, and then you give me a Yudalit. Rather, it's giving us a roadmap for what are really 7 years of conquest. And we may see another story in Yudalit that's going to be, this happened during what we just described as the 7 years of conquest. So don't think of this as, turn that it, you know, it's now it's Thursday, and this was done, and then the next thing that's listed here must have happened on Friday. Mm. It's not like that. It plays out over time.
It's a very, like a synopsis, really.
Yeah. Precisely.
And then they go into detail later. You're saying
exactly.
Later,
so Kalev's conquest in year 5 is what we're talking about here. That's so that's an approach. It is associated with Yahushua because he is the commander on whose orders the conquest takes place. Right? We don't think literally Yahushua is marching through all of these cities and he is the one who is doing all of this. He is the leader. And the text itself is depending on the reader to see what's going to happen in later chapters, which will provide the details for how things actually took place. So that's Malvin's second take. Abarbanel takes that view as well, and that seems to also be a reasonable way to resolve the problem. So they've now conquered a whole series of cities, but they're not done. If you take a look at Pasuk Lamed Chet, sentence 38, Vayashav Yehoshua b'chol Yisrael imo Devira. The Jews then go back to Devir. And when we say they go back to Devir, if you're looking at your maps, you realize that now they're sort of turning back toward the west and the south. Right? They've gone west, they've gone south, they went east towards Hebron, and now they're going to go south again and west in order to attack Devir.
Is there a certain order they're going in?
It's this conquest of the whole region that we think of as more or less a central region. That's what they're doing here, and it's just the pattern of it is based, I think, on where the cities themselves are located. You consolidate, you make sure you can't be attacked, and then you go a little bit further in line. So they attack Devir, Vayil Kedaves, Malkaves, Kolareha, they take Devir, the king, all of the Arim, the sub cities, the outskirts, Vayakum Lifichara, they struck them by the sword, Vechrimus Kolne Vashasherba. Once again, everybody within. Loishir Sarid, they leave no one. Kashera Salah Hebron, Kena Salah Devira, Ulamalka. They seem to be calling the city's name not Devir, but Devira. That's actually the name. It's always confusing because when you say to a place in Biblical Hebrew, you will often add the kamas he ending. So Devira could be to Devir. Mm-hmm. Sorry?
Would it not have the dekesh?
No. That would be her Devir.
The trick is that
what I thought the city's name was. Is just that now Asa Lidavira makes me sort of question that. The answer could be that it goes by both names. Actually, that Mikra says it should be Devir, and this hay is extra. Okay, and then he says, as I was about to say, that it could be that the city was known by both names. Remember, when you're not dealing with a society in which everything is in writing, you get variations like this. In the same way that there's Yirmiah and Yirmiyahu, Yeshaya, Yeshayahu, and so on, it wasn't a big deal because no one asked how they needed to spell it. So you could have legitimately both usages. So they did to Devira, and her king, Mekashara Salah Livno, Lamalka, as they had done to Livna. Vayake Yehoshua, Pasuk Mem. Now we're moving towards the south in terms of the conquest. In general, he swept west, south, then back east, sort of methodically sweeping through. But Dan Mikra and Malvin both emphasize that from here forward is going to be conquest of the south. Okay, Yehoshua is kol ha'aretz. Yehoshua conquers the whole land. Ha'har, the mountain, meaning the central mountainous area. Ba'anegev. Negev here does not mean all the way down to Eilat. They did not go down to Eilat. But Negev means the drier area that is to the south. Vehashfela, the low-lying areas. Veha Ashedot. Ashedot, Rashi renders as the place where water runs down from the hills. And that's the Ashedot. Ves Kol Malchehem and all of their kings. Lohishir Sarid, they left no one. Ves Kol Neshama Hecharim. They wiped out everybody. Kasher Tziva Hashem Elokei Yisrael, as Hashem, God of Israel, had commanded. From Kadesh Barnea all the way to Aza, which is in the west, right? That's the land of the Plishtim. Whether there are Plishtim there at that time is another discussion, but it's in that region toward the Mediterranean. The is kol Eretz Goshen, Ve'ad Givon, all the land of Goshen, up to Givon. There are those who actually suggest that this Goshen is the Goshen of Egypt, but generally speaking, we assume not. This is another area also named Goshen. Yeshua conquers them and their kings at once. At once does not mean physically at the same time. We've already said it's a 7-year period of conquest. But what we mean, according to Radak, and Dat Mikra, means one after the other. There were no big sieges, long battles. It was just one right after the other. And Tzudat David says it was one attack per location, as opposed to Ai, where they had to attack twice. It was just one attack per site. Because God was battling on behalf of Israel. And finally, the parak concludes, Vayashav Yoshua v'chol Yisrael imo el ha-machane ha-Gilgala. They went back to Gilgal, which you will recall from last week, we read already in Pasuk Tevav. Right? The same exact sentence was in sentence 15. And we gave at that point multiple explanations. We suggested the one view is that they planned to go to Gilgal initially, but then they got word of these five kings, and that spurred the series of attacks, and then eventually they returned to Gilgal. A second approach that we had was they went to Gilgal, then they heard about the kings, then they went on these wars, and then they went back to Gilgal. So in other words, they did go to Gilgal twice, and the fact that the pasuk is just same wording twice is, you know, coincidence. Or convergent evolution, I suppose, because the sentence works when I use it twice. And then the third approach was that when we said it initially, it was like we just said about these wars in general. It's overview, and then specific things that happened. So it's that. They went to Gilgal, and now we explain what happened. They actually went to Gilgal, but first they had a whole series of wars, and then they returned to Gilgal. However you look at it, they're now home in the spot to which they had gone when they crossed over the Yarden. We've had this series of attacks on the cities, and this is what they had tried to prevent by sending their letters in the first place and saying, we'd like to make peace with you. And we're going to see explicitly in the next parak that no one wanted to. The only ones who wanted to were Givon, right, who played their game that started this parak. But the rest of them were not interested, and this is what ensued. So to summarize the parak, what we've seen here is the attack on Givon by their panicked neighbors, who are also very angry at Givon for making peace. We saw the Jews decide to honor their pact that they had made with Givon, whether that was really required by their deal or not. They said, we're going to defend Givon. There wasn't any overt consultation with God, although the commentators do seem to suggest that something must have happened. They must have asked God, what am I doing here? Should we or shouldn't we? The nation is behind Yehoshua. Hashem is with Yehoshua. Miracles return in support of the Jews there. We got the whole discussion about what those miracles were. Did the sun stop? How long did it stop? Why did it stop? Was it necessary for it to stop? What does that mean for Yehoshua's relationship with Moshe? Was Yehoshua greater than Moshe? And the bottom line demonstration that Hashem is supporting Yehoshua. That's the parak in a nutshell. Okay?
So it sounds like, you know, they conquer, okay, we just read it, and all is nice and all is good, but if you really stop and think about it, like, what is happening in these places, right? So they conquer, they move on, and now it's desolate. Has anyone stayed behind? Is anyone building up these places? Is it just, they conquer, they leave, and then can anyone come from the north and just, I don't know.
Right, so I would say two things. One, theoretically, I would not have a problem with the idea that they, in fact, leave it vacant and that others theoretically could come in. Their mission in the land is clear out the people God has said have been so horrible that they just don't belong here. So hypothetically, somebody else comes in and they're, you know, nice people. Great. That's a hypothetical answer. In practice, though, the answer is that they spent 7 years, after the 7 years of conquest, they spent 7 years dividing everything up and settling this space. And we'll see them allocate these cities to different tribes. So in practice,
nothing's
I think that's
been built
actually...
up yet. Nothing has been...
Right.
Did
do they destroy the infrastructure in the cities too? Like,
are they eating?
There's any agricultural, I don't know what's going on in these cities. But,
right.
You know.
So I don't see any indication of that. There's some discussion about the word vayacharim that's used a couple of times. But generally speaking, we don't have any mention of, other than one or two cities that we do see it for. There's no burning of the city. They're not demolishing the infrastructure.
But were the people still there?
No.
Everybody?
When it says they didn't leave anybody, I think that's what that's literal.
Yeah,
yeah.
They didn't.
What
did
they
do?
So it was just empty.
Not really.
Out of the fields.
Meaning no one's, like we're saying, they're not building up, they haven't divided up that this is your land, this is my land, who's in charge of tending to the farms, and like, you know what
right.
I mean?
It's just... Right, I mean, keep in mind...
It's 14 years to come by, it's not like, you think they finally got 40 years in the desert, the kids finally got there, let me settle, let me get a home, and ask 14 years longer, you know?
Well, the kids are on the eastern side of the Yarding. It's the right. warriors who are doing all of this, or maybe they're in Gilgal.
What do you mean, the kids?
That's true. Actually, no, they're in Gilgal. Their kids are in Gilgal.
Right.
So the kids are in Gilgal, and
they finish the war. They go back home.
Are we there yet? Yeah.
They go back home.
When your kids complain, it's our time to raise.
But keep it. No, the fact that they haven't divided up the land does not preclude them from doing any sort of agriculture, getting any sort of provisions.
Right.
You know, they're able to do, and frankly, when you conquer a city, if you're not burning it down, you're going to get whatever supplies were there.
So they left people there to not be charged, or they went back each time they needed
it? We don't get any reference. Yeah. We don't know. There's information we get, and there's information we don't get. The text's primary concern seems to be to say they did what God had told them to do. Right? This last 15 psukim, 16 psukim are basically centered around they did what they had been told was their mission in the land. Which brings us to Perigit Aleph, chapter 11. If you were hoping for it to get sunnier, no. This basically, Perigit Aleph is a series of wars. And then Yud Bet is going to be a record of the dead, who actually was destroyed in those wars. And then it'll move into division of the land. But this is, we are now in the area of Yoshua that people don't read. Because it's just not an interesting story. You know, it's not, the sun didn't stop, the moon didn't stop, no one took from the spoils. It's just, you know, text.
Did they mention anywhere, were there any casualties in the Jews?
Didn't say anything about it. Doesn't mean it didn't happen. We didn't mention that there were no casualties either.
Right.
So it's possible. Perigit Aleph has four basic parts to it. If you look at the outline I gave you on your sheet. The first five psukim deal with an attack led by Yavin, king of Hazor. Then the next several psukim are the Jews counterattacking, followed by a conquest of cities in the north, although it's not all north, as we'll see. Followed by three psukim about the remainder of the wars, and the basic themes here are the relationship between Hashem and Yahushua, we'll see, as well as, for the first time, really, some element of the non-physical dangers to the Jewish people in this land. What does that mean, the non-physical dangers that the people are facing?
Assimilation.
Yeah, assimilation, spiritual concerns, Avodah Zarah, the concern of becoming like the inhabitants of the land. That's not something we've really seen yet, but it enters into the picture now in this parak. Take a look, please, at the opening part, the first five psukim. Vayihi, Kishmoa Yavin Melech Hatzor. It was when Yavin, king of Hatzor, heard. This is like our favorite beginning, right? We use this beginning also in Parak Tet. We've used it a bunch of times. And it was when he heard. We're so used to it that it doesn't even tell us what he heard. And it was when Yavin, king of Hatzor, heard. Presumably, what he heard was what happened in the previous Parak. He sends to Yovav, king of Madon. He sends also to the king of Shimron. He also sends to the king of Achshaf. And the kings that are in the north, Baharu Ba'arava, on the mountain, in the plains, Negev Kinrot, south of the Kinneret. Ubashefela, as well as in the low-lying areas, Ubinafos Dor Miyam, and in the heights of Dor, or the villages of Dor, off to the west. So this is generally, as explained by Dan Mikra, a group of kings that are more northerly. The cities that we're mentioning here are ancient cities of Canaan. They are known cities of Canaan, like we know where these places are. Chatzor, in particular, is known as a mighty city, and Dan Mikra actually suggests, if you noticed what happened in the first pasuk there, that the we named Yavin king of Chatzor. We named Yovav king of Madon. We didn't mention the name of the king of Shimron or the king of Achshaph. Those don't get named. They are subsidiary to the king of Chatzor. Frankly, they don't matter. Like, they have a population, so they get mentioned, but they had no independence themselves. So these kings are summoned by Yavin, king of Chatzor, and you know what's going to happen at this point. It's like, why bother reading the rest of the parak? You know where this is going. But nonetheless, you have to watch the car crash. Haknanim imizrahu miyam, the Canaanites from the east as well as the west. V'ha'emori v'achiti v'aprizi v'ayivusi bahar. Emori chiti prizi v'usi on the mountain, v'achivi tachas chermon, v'chivi who lived under har chermon. Be'eretz ha-mitzpah, in the land of the mitzpah. We're going to come back to mitzpah. We're not done with mitzpah. But that's the name for this region. Vayitzu heim v'chol machaneihem imam. They went out with all of their camps. Am rav kachol asher al spas hayam larov. Like the sand by the sea in number, meaning that this is a larger group than you've seen so far. No one else has been named like this until now. This is a very large population coming out to war with the Jews. And visus varechev rav me'od. They have horses and they have chariots. And we don't. And by Yivadu, kol ha-malachim ha'ela, all of these kings joined together. Lehi va'ed suggests that you set up a time, a mo'ed, and you gather. Vayavo vayachnu yachdav el mei meirom. They gathered in a place called mei meirom. Lehi lachem im Yisrael, to fight with Israel. Dan Mikra goes through a few different suggestions for what mei meirom might be. He says some identify it with meiron, and suggest that that's what was going on. Presumably they wanted to daven at the grave of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. They needed haircuts. It was like Bomer. He ends up saying that the places that tend to be identified are way up north, and that it really doesn't fit. Yoshua, it doesn't make sense for Yoshua to go up north to battle them, because he would be vulnerable. He'd be stretched too far from his base. So he offers a different identification of where this is. What did he write? Right, he had another reason for not saying it, actually. He said, because if you go too far north, you get into mountainous terrain. People with iron chariots don't like mountainous terrain. That's not where they would have gathered for war with Yahushua. So he suggests...
But if they could come down from the north, they've got to meet him somewhere. So if they are located north and they want to attack him, then they've got to come down.
Right, but they wouldn't have had their chariots up in the mountains. That's what he's saying. That's not where you keep chariots. They're not useful. So he suggests that it's somewhere in the valley near Har HaGalil, the mountain of the Galil, which I don't know if you have a map like this, like the Dot Mikra one, but he offers a couple of different possibilities for where it could be. Either he has it way up, I mean, Chatzor is up here also, north of the Kinneret. So either he has it near Chatzor, or he has it further south, parallel with the Kinneret, east of the Kinneret. Which I think makes more sense in terms of his arguments.
East of the Kinneret, west of the Kinneret?
West of the Kinneret, yeah. Yeah, and the Dominican picture is an interesting picture. This is, you have the Kinneret here, and Mei Meirom here, or way up there, depending on which take you.
And where is Meirom today? Where is the modern Meirom?
Meirom, with the Nun, does he mark off? No, he doesn't mark it off. But it would be, I would think, up here.
Yeah.
I would think that's what he would be saying. Mm-hmm. I'm terrible with maps. Which does not mean as directions. But you can see he's got Chatzor here. He's got Kinrot here on the Kinneret. And other places which we're going to get to as we go through this paragraph.
And that's where there is a modern-day Chatzor, isn't there?
I don't know.
I think it's somewhere around Pesach, isn't
there? It sounds right, but I don't remember. So this attack is then different from the southern cities which we talked about. This is clearly northern, and you can just you can tell based on the fact that we're dealing with the Kinneret as our landmark instead of Yam HaMelech as our landmark. The kings there gather, and the land is the land of the Mitzpah. So that was particularly interesting, reading about Mitzpah, because Mitzpah is a major gathering place for the Jews further along in Tanakh. That's where they coronate Shaul. That's in Yiftach's time. Like, that's a major gathering place. Now, the truth is, Mitzpah means what?
Overlooking,
right. So Fair, right? And so Fair is a scout, somebody who looks out. Tzipia is your anticipation, what you are looking forward to having happen. So a Mitzpah is just an outlook, an overlook. It doesn't have to be one place. There can be many places called Mitzpah, just like there can be many places called Gilgal. These are geographic features that we're talking about. The Amek. There can be a lot of places called an Amek. So it doesn't have to be the same place, but Radak suggests it is. If you take a look at source number 3, look what Radak has to say. He says, "Ve'efsher shezeh makom hu ha-mitzpah shehayu miskavtzim sham Yisrael tamid." This mitzpah could be the same mitzpah where the Jews perpetually gathered. Ulefi shehaisa sham tshu'a gedola, because there was a great salvation there. Hayu no'adim sham, they would gather there. Ki b'melchama ha-acheret shehasa Yehoshua em chameshes ha-melachim, avu pi shehaisa tshu'a gedola lo hayu ela chameshes melachim, ve'elu hayu melachim rabim. He says Yehoshua's earlier ones that we mentioned, the southern kings, that was basically 5 kings. That's not as big a deal. This involves many, many more kings. There's a much greater conquest going on here. We're going to enumerate them in the 12th parak. And so he says maybe this became a gathering place because that was the locus of a remarkable victory. That's one suggestion that he gives. Then he gives a second suggestion, which is a bit more loaded. He says, "Ve'efsher, it's also possible, ki bana sham Yehoshua mizbeach, that Yehoshua actually built an altar there." And the reason why I say this is a loaded suggestion is because it's not the Mishkan. The Mishkan is in Gilgal, and then in Shiloh, and then in Ovin Gibbon, and so on. But it's not here. But Yehoshua builds an altar anyway on this site. Why would he do that? Mibnei ha-tshu'a gedola shehaisa sham, because of the great salvation that was there. I'm not suggesting what he does is wrong. There's no prohibition at that time on building another, what's called a bama, a private altar. He could do that. It's just an interesting decision. So he says it's to commemorate their victory. Hayu Yisrael, I shouldn't say the victory, but he calls it tshu'a, their rescue, their salvation by Hashem. So when the Jews needed to go to war, that's where they gathered. Or if they had some other great thing, which is why, and he brings you a series of psukim reflecting different gatherings that went on there. In each of these psukim he's about to bring, it says that they were lifnei Hashem, in front of God. What do you mean in front of God? Because there was a mizbeach there. That's the idea, lifnei Hashem v'mitzpah. You can read the passage yourself there. In front of Hashem in mitzpah with Yiftach, Pilagish Begiva, in Shmuel's day for war with the Plishtim, for coronating Shaul. And so he says, he believes that there was actually a mizbeach there, and a house dedicated for tefillah, and for the Jews to gather there in those days. And that's why you had, that's why it became such an important site for the Jews. Okay?
Yeah, I have a question. Yeah. I just checked those things, so I remember. Yavin Malachat Sora was in the story with Sisra, because I was thinking that he was there. So obviously they're going to kill him now. Is that the name of the king, like Pharaoh? Like, is it the same person? What happened there?
Right, so it's quite possible that it's an inherited title. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't looked at the Mepharshim to see, you're right, that he's there.
I was thinking, why does that sound familiar to me so much?
Yeah. But the answer could well be that it's an inherited talent. Yavin, person of comprehension or something along
like
those lines.
But I guess another question would be, like, obviously we know what happened with Shochi. Obviously, there were problems in that book, too. So, Yeshua's going to capture all these places in Jerusalem and everything's going to be great. But then what happens? Some of these cities get rebuilt later on by Canadian members that survived? Or
can happen, yes.
So not everyone was decimated then. Because I know Rufus that we're saying everyone was killed.
Right, the populations of these cities. However, there's always more. I mean, one of the things this Shabbos Rabbing is Shabbaton at Shari Shemayim, for those who read the email this morning. So we're doing a play on Esther's war. And it's about bloodshed and the issues that are raised by the fights on Purim as well. And one of the points that we're going to be making is that the war with Amalek actually goes on throughout Tanakh. People are sort of familiar with the attack at the end of Parshas Bishalach, which is retold in Ki Teitzeh, and we read that for Parshas Zachor, and that's its own event. But they don't realize that there are actually quite a few battles with Amalek, both in Chumash and in the early books of Navi. The fight with Amalek keeps on going, and there are multiple times in which it looks like Amalek has been wiped out, and yet they're like the zombies of the Torah. They just keep on coming back. They keep on returning. The idea that Haman is descendant of Amalek is a problem.
No, but isn't that because Shaul let them live, let the king live, and so then he, in the meantime,
right,
he was able to reproduce.
So that's a way that Medrash tries to resolve the problem. But the Medrash notes that this is a real problem because a god lives one day, and he's the only survivor. And so they suggest there was a woman who was smuggled in, and therefore, she has a child from him, and that somehow, presto, the problem with that idea, as the explanation, is that the story of the war between Shaul and Amalek is in the 15th parak in Shmuel Aleph. Okay? When you get to parak Chav Zayin, which is not that much later chronologically, I don't know how many months we're talking about, but we're not talking about a long period of time, David HaMelech is camped with the Philistines, with the Plishtim, and he and his men raid a city of Amalek. There's a city that is an Amalekite city. And three chapters after that, and again, not much time has elapsed, it's not like there's some passage in between saying 10 years later. Three chapters later, David and his men, who are still living among the Philistines, have left a city called Ziklag to go to war. They come back and find that Amalek has raided and burned down the entire city and taken all the women captive and so on. I thought there was just one of them left. How in the world did that happen? And the answer goes back to what I said earlier about the way these tribes worked. There were multiple tribes multiple clans that were all under one tribal name. There's Chiti here, and there's Chiti here, and there's Chiti here, and there's Amaleki here, and Amaleki here, and Amaleki there. And they're all cousins, and under the same overall banner, but there are clearly multiple populations.
Maybe like Chatzor, you're saying, is the lead city of this region. Maybe that's not really Chatzor in Caesar's time.
I don't know. But I'm saying that in general, the issue of whether cities were rebuilt and so on, even if you say, as we just said, that all of these cities were destroyed and their population was wiped out and there was no one left, that doesn't mean that that Canaanite tribe is gone. It means that city belonging to the Canaanite tribe is gone. But yeah, they're elsewhere as well. That's the idea. So, going back to what happens here in this parak, you have a massive army of many, many kings, besides the ones who we mentioned in the beginning of the parak, who have gathered to fight the Jews, many as the sand by the sea, and they have chariots. They're better armed than the previous people were. Now, the ending is still going to be the same, because that's the way it works. So if you look at Psukim Vav to Tet, sentences 6 to 9, Vayomer Hashem al Yehoshua, God says to Yehoshua, Al tira b'pneihem, do not fear them. Right? A familiar speech. We've seen this before. Ki machar ka'eis hazos, anochi nosein es kulam chalalim lifnei Yisrael. Tomorrow, at this time, I am going to make them all corpses before Israel. Es suseihem te'aker. You will literally uproot their horses, and what he's talking about is hobbling the horse, damaging the hoof. And we'll see why in a moment. Ves markavosehem tistrof ba'esh, and you shall burn their chariots. Vayavo Yoshua v'chol ama milchama imo aleihem al mei meirom pitom. Yoshua and his soldiers attack suddenly, right? The ambush technique which he has used successfully in the past. Vayiblu bahem, and they fell upon them, or the enemy fell to them. Depends on who Vayiblu is referring to. Vayitnei Hashem b'yad Yisrael, God gave them into the hands of Israel. Vayakum, they struck them. Vayirdefum ad Tzidon Rabbah, they chased them all the way to Great Tzidon. Tzidon being a Phoenician port city on the Mediterranean. Vaad Misrafot Mayim, to the Misrafot Mayim. That mikra here says Misrafot Mayim is an Arabic term, this Misrafot, and it means an elevated place. The usual translation that you see in the commentators is that this is a place where they would dig channels, let the seawater run into it, and then desalinate it by having the sun, well, it's not really desalinating, it's more dehydrating it, letting the sun burn off the water, and then you add salt. It was a salt refinery of sorts. So that's where they chase them to. That Bikat Mitzpeh Mizracha, as well as to the fields of or the plains of Mitzpeh in the east. That's the Eretz HaMitzpah that we talked about before. Vayakum ad bilti yishir lahem sarid, they struck them until, you guessed it, nothing was left. Vayas lahem Yoshua kasher amar lo Hashem, and Yoshua did as God had told him to do. Esu sehem iker, they hobbled the horses. Ves markavo sehem saraf ba'esh, and they burned the chariots. Yeah, what are you doing? Well, first of all, they are keeping the horses. They didn't kill the horses. Okay. Right? That's an important note.
If they
injured
them,
then what?
They're not going to be a lot of use to them, are they?
They're going to be zero use to them.
Right.
That is true. So take a look on your sheet. You already know the answer to this. But take a look on your sheet at source number 4. The Hebrew is at the bottom of one side. The English is at the top of the next side. V'tziva kadosh baruch hu la'abed hasusim b'harechev shehayu hagoyim nelchamim bahem. Hashem instructed them to destroy, although when he uses the word destroy, it's really a misnomer, and he himself corrects it later, and all the commentators say they're not killing the horses. That's not their point. Their point is to make them useless, so that they can't use them as weapons. He says they destroy the horses and chariots shehayu hagoyim nelchamim bahem that the enemy fought them with. Ubatchu b'rechbam, the enemy who had trusted their chariots, Kirav, because there were so many of them. Velo yadu ki sheker asus litshua, the enemy did not know that this is a false salvation, the horses. The Israel below rechav asus nitzchum, the pilum chalalim, ki lashem hatshua, the Jews had managed to defeat them without having any horses, without having any chariots. Salvation is with God. Lefichach laratza hakel yisbarach sheavuzu Yisrael alahem hasusim v'amerkavot. Therefore, God didn't want the Jews to take these as spoils, so that they don't come to trust in having this kind, these kinds of weapons. They're going to think we win because we have horses, because we have chariots. This is what I meant when I said the non-physical dangers. There's a concern that you come to believe that it's all about the weapons. So therefore, they are told specifically to hobble the horse, not to destroy it, but to hobble it. There's actually discussion about this. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah discusses this too. I didn't bring it here, but this was their technique in order to remember Hashem is with us, and that's why we are victorious. That it ultimately is from God, and that's a theme that we're going to see become more important as we continue with the Navi. This awareness that it's from Hashem. I think we'll pick up with that next week. We're going to be covering a lot more ground here as we go through, because there isn't as much in terms of story until we get to the end of the book where the story resumes.